was the emerging reggae scene. So, so much that we all went in there, and this was the result.
The satellite's gone up to the sky. Things like that they drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while, and I could watch things on TV. Your satellite of love, your satellite of love, your satellite of love. The satellite's gone way up to Mars. Soon it'll be filled with parking cars. I watched it, baby, for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Satellite of love, your satellite of love, satellite of. I've been told, babe, that you've been bobo, baby, with Harry, Mark, and John. Monday and Tuesday, bobo, baby, Wednesday, Thursday, with Harry, Mark, and John. This is what I said. Things like that drive me out of my mind. I watched it for a little while. I like to watch things on TV. Oh, you're sad and light of love. Baby, sad and light of love. Satellite of love, satellite of love.
Aus neutraler Sicht. Von Albert Jörrimann.
Guten Tag. Bisher hatte ich Pedro Sanchez immer für einen sowieso sympathischen und auch glaubwürdigen Politiker gehalten, soweit dies im Rahmen des politischen Spiels überhaupt möglich ist. Auf seine Art erschien er wie eine tatsächlich sozialdemokratische Alternative zur Generation von Tony Blair und Gerhard Schröder. Kein Kommunist oder Linksaußen, bewahre. Wie es um deren Chancen steht, im Rahmen der kapitalistischen Interessensgeometrie an die Macht zu kommen, hat man in England anhand von Jeremy Corbyn gesehen. Noch nicht mal der bewusst unsorgfältige Umgang mit dem Antisemitismus hat ihm die Regierungsverantwortung in die Tasche gespült. Ganz abgesehen vom absehbar realpolitischen Umgang mit dieser Regierungsverantwortung, wenn man sie dann mal hat. Die griechische Syriza hat eine Zeit lang Züge einer radikal linken Partei gehabt, um sie aber in den Verhandlungen mit der Troika schnell abzustoßen. Und die spanischen Podemos ist zwar spürbar radikaler als die Sozialisten, macht aber ebenfalls nicht mehr Stunk als nötig, um in der Regierung zu bleiben. Alles in bester sozialdemokratischer Ordnung, dachte ich mir, bis Sanchez am letzten Freitag zum Präsidenten der Sozialistischen Internationale gewählt wurde. Er löst dort Georgios Papandreou ab, welcher die Verknöcherung und Verfilzung dieser Institution wie kaum ein anderer repräsentiert. Er war beteiligt an den Betrügereien rund um den EU-Beitritt Griechenlands und anschließend in verantwortlicher Position an praktisch jedem weiteren Beschiss, der das Land in die Schuldenkrise ritt. Er war griechischer Ministerpräsident, als Sohn eines früheren griechischen Ministerpräsidenten und als Enkel eines früheren griechischen Ministerpräsidenten, selbstverständlich beide Sozialisten, und steht damit für die Umwandlung der griechischen Sozialisten in eine Erbmonarchie, selbstverständlich immer am Halsband der internationalen Kapitalisten und der griechischen Kirche. Und jetzt Pedro Sanchez. Was soll das? Sogar die deutsche SPD hat ihre Beitragszahlungen an die Sozialistische Internationale von 100.000 auf 5.000 Pfund reduziert und nimmt nur noch als Beobachterin an den Beratungen teil. Vollmitglieder sind dagegen Parteien wie der African National Council, der Partido Aprista Peruano, die mexikanische Partei der institutionalisierten Revolution als Erbauerin des modernen mexikanischen Staates, der indische Nationalkongress und so weiter, denen man vieles vorwerfen kann, aber nicht die Treue zu grundlegenden Prinzipien des Sozialismus und meistens noch nicht mal des Sozialdemokratismus. Offenbar geht die Ära Sanchez zu Ende. Und ja, wenn er dies nun rasch durchzieht, wird von Pedro Sanchez tatsächlich die Erinnerung an einen sympathischen und glaubwürdigen Politiker bleiben, während er in der Versenkung der Sozialistischen Internationale verschwindet. Und wer wird sein Nachfolger? Vermutlich wird es eine Nachfolgerin. Die Vorsitzende des Parteivorstandes Cristina Narbona Ruiz ist mit ihren 72 Jahren zu alt, um den nach wie vor jugendlich wirkenden Sanchez zu beerben. Trotz beeindruckendem wirtschaftspolitischem Rucksack und dem besten Wahlergebnis des ganzen Landes bei den Senatswahlen 2019. Ich denke eher an die stellvertretende Generalsekretärin Adriana Lastra Fernandez, die aus den Reihen der Jungsozialistinnen hervorgegangen ist, deren Generalsekretärin sie von 1999 bis 2004 war. Vielleicht wird es auch Teresa Ribera, aktuell dritte stellvertretende Ministerpräsidentin im Kabinett und Ministerin für den ökologischen Wandel. Einen Mann werden sich die spanischen Sozialdemokratinnen in diesen Zeiten nicht leisten. Wie verhält es sich eigentlich mit den polnischen Forderungen nach Reparationszahlungen durch Deutschland für die Beschädigungen im Zweiten Weltkrieg? Einmal abgesehen davon, dass es sich bei diesen Forderungen um ebenso klare wie aussichtslose Ablenkungsmanöver der polnischen Regierung handelt, welche sie als einen Hebel einsetzt, um die gegen sie laufenden Verfahren der Europäischen Kommission mindestens leicht zu behindern. Es gibt jedenfalls zu dieser Frage einen Artikel im schlauen Buch des Fähnleins Fieselschweif, welcher zunächst auf Staatsverträge verweist, wie zum Beispiel die Potsdamer Konferenz 1945, welche die Aufteilung von Nazi-Deutschland und vor allem den Ausgleich für die Kriegsschäden in der Sowjetunion zum Inhalt hatte. 1953 verzichtete Polen unter sowjetischem Druck auf alle Forderungen an Deutschland. Genau dieser Verzicht wird heute in Frage gestellt mit der Begründung, die damalige Regierung sei nicht demokratisch legitimiert gewesen. Deutschland hält dagegen mit dem Argument, dass das heutige Polen unter allen Titeln die Rechtsnachfolgerin des Vorgängerstaates sei. Den jüngsten Nagel in das Vertragswerk schlugen die Abmachungen zur deutschen Wiedervereinigung im Jahr 1990 ein, in denen von Reparationszahlungen nicht die Rede war. Polen war an den Verhandlungen zwar nicht beteiligt, legte aber auch keinen Widerspruch ein. Laut Wikipedia vermutlich darum, weil sonst die Oder-Neiße-Grenze wieder hätte diskutiert werden müssen. Im Jahr 2004 flackerte die Diskussion um Reparationszahlungen von polnischer Seite erneut auf, nachdem von Seite von deutschen Vertriebenenverbänden Forderungen nach einer Entschädigung für enteigneten Besitz in Schlesien gestellt worden waren. Ein gemeinsam von Deutschland und Polen in Auftrag gegebenes Rechtsgutachten lehnte darauf die Forderungen beider Seiten ab. Es versteht sich von selber, dass verschiedene Abgeordnete der polnischen PiS-Partei später, nämlich im Jahr 2017, das Gutachten für ungültig erklärten, mindestens soweit es die polnischen Forderungen an Deutschland betraf, und den polnischen Mitautor des Gutachtens strafrechtlich belangen wollten. Im gleichen Jahr gab das polnische Parlament ein neues Gutachten in Auftrag, das ein Guthaben Polens bei Deutschland von 850 Milliarden Euro errechnete. Die letzten Monat von der polnischen Regierung geltend gemachte Summe beträgt nun offenbar 1,3 Billionen Euro. Und dann nennt Wikipedia noch die tatsächlich geleisteten Reparationszahlungen nicht an den Staat, sondern an Opfer des Nationalsozialismus in Polen. Sie umfangen ungefähr 3 Milliarden Euro. Auf der symbolischen Ebene schlägt Deutschland nun aber zurück, und zwar mit dem Budget für das nächste Jahr, in dem zum ersten Mal Mittel für den Unterricht der polnischen Sprache für polnische Einwandererinnen vorgesehen sind, nämlich eine volle Million Euro. In den Folgejahren wird diese Summe auf 2 Millionen jährlich aufgestockt. Man geht allerdings davon aus, dass diese Maßnahme auch auf Druck der Senkung des Budgets für den Deutschunterricht der deutschsprachigen Minderheit in Polen durch die polnische Regierung erfolgt ist. Diese deutschsprachige Minderheit besteht zwar nicht aus Einwandererinnen, aber das tut der schönen polnischen Initiative keinen Abbruch. Was ist aus neutraler Sicht davon zu halten? Nichts. Die deutsche Haltung, wonach der polnische Staat die Rechtsnachfolge des sozialistischen Vorgängerstaates angetreten hat, ist auf jeden Fall korrekt. Damit sind neue Verhandlungen in dieser Angelegenheit natürlich nicht vollständig ausgeschlossen, aber sie müssen auf dieser Grundlage stattfinden und selbstverständlich nicht auf der Grundlage von Gebrüll und Geschrei und juristischem Gezerre im Stil von Donald Trump. Am 23. November wurde in Luanda ein Waffenstillstandsabkommen für die Auseinandersetzungen im Osten der Demokratischen Republik Kongo zwischen der Rebellengruppe M23 und Regierungstruppen geschlossen. International wird Ruanda als wichtigste Unterstützerin der Rebellen angegeben. Es war an den Verhandlungen durch Außenminister Vincent Biruta vertreten. Beschlossen wurde eine Waffenruhe ab dem 25. November und der Rückzug des M23 aus den besetzten Gebieten. Allerdings war das M23 an den Verhandlungen selber nicht beteiligt und fühlt sich dementsprechend nicht an den Waffenstillstand gebunden. Andererseits behauptet die Gruppierung, dass sie sich sowieso schon seit April dieses Jahres einseitig einen Waffenstillstand auferlegt habe. Das ist angesichts der gemeldeten Gefechte eine ziemlich lustige Haltung, welche man unter die Kategorie Narrative ablegen kann. Libyen hat am 24. November 105 Ägypterinnen, 101 Bürgerinnen des Tschad sowie 20 Sudanesinnen zurück in ihre Heimatländer spediert. Bisher war die Verantwortung für die Rückführungen bei den zuständigen UNO-Organen gelegen. Jetzt haben sich die Libyerinnen intern auf ein gemeinsames Vorgehen geeinigt und übernehmen die Ausführung selber. Mit solchen Aktionen wird der Migrationsstrom selbstverständlich nicht aufgehalten. Als Drehscheibe für die Weiterreise übers Mittelmeer bleibt Libyen weiterhin attraktiv, solange nicht eine allgemein anerkannte Regierung mit entsprechenden staatlichen Institutionen für Regeln und ihre Durchsetzung sorgen. Aber die internationale Aufmerksamkeit registriert immerhin, dass eben nicht nur diese Drehscheibe für Migrantinnen aus den Ländern südlich der Sahara Menschen aus Afrika als Sprungbrett für Europa dient, sondern dass immer mehr Menschen aus dem Maghreb die Reise nach Norden antreten. Da sind wir wieder beim alten Thema der strategischen Ausrichtung der Europäischen Union. Auch wenn Deutschland im Moment von einer zusätzlichen EU-Erweiterung nichts wissen will, wenn nicht die internen Regeln geändert werden, also wenn nicht das Vetorecht der Mitgliedstaaten abgeschafft wird, so ist im Moment der Fokus auf den Osten bis an den Aralsee wirklich beelendend. Im Süden, wo man mit echter Arbeit und Zusammenarbeit nicht nur verschiedene Probleme zum Wohle aller Beteiligten lösen könnte, sondern wo damit auch die Grundlage für die zunehmende Fremdenfeindlichkeit bekämpft werden könnte, also für das EU-interne Problem des rechten Nationalismus mit seinen Annex-Problemen aus dem Komplex des Donald-Trumpismus, gerade hier scheint sich niemand um Lösungen und Möglichkeiten zu kümmern. Die Verantwortung für dieses Defizit möchte ich ausnahmsweise mal Ursula von der Leyen zuschieben, welche ihr Amt genau für solche Ausrichtungen nutzen könnte. Offenbar ist sie einfach nicht in der Lage, von sich aus die Bedeutung von Afrika für Europa zu erkennen, und ebenso offenbar gibt es rund um sie auch keine Beraterinnen, welche ihr ein paar Informationen zustecken. Stattdessen steckt Frau von der Leyen nach wie vor im Korsett, welches von der Brühwurst José Barroso geschneidert wurde, während sich ihr Vorgänger Juncker nicht besonders darum gekümmert hat. Das ist dumm. Guten Tag.
Aus neutraler Sicht. Von Albert Jörimann.
Welcome to Passive Aggressive Conversations, a collaboration between The Lake Radio and Passive Aggressive, where a couple of passive aggressive journalists sit down for a cozy conversation program with the leading lights of the Danish music scene. I'm one of your hosts, Megan Holt, and with me is Ivna Franek.
Hi.
And today we have the absolute pleasure of talking to Aria Lit Schütze about their work, their new album Limerence, and everything that's going on in their world and projects. So yeah. Welcome, Aria.
Thank you.
So we had the pleasure of being at your concert on Saturday night.
That's right.
Yeah, where you performed the entirety of your new record.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. Like maybe, yeah, almost all of it.
Yeah. What did you cut?
Some of the collaboratory tracks.
Oh yeah,
couldn't have Holger singing with me. And
Yeah. Okay, well, it didn't seem like you were missing things from the performance. I guess it held together coherently, and that was a great experience. Like really made, I think, a lot of like the emotional weight of the album land. So I guess if we could just kick things off, I think, by asking you what were your intentions behind this record, and like what were you trying to get across with it?
Yeah. So this album, I started out when I moved to Berlin 2 years ago, I think, when I graduated from the conservatory in Copenhagen. And then I were going through a heartbreak. And then I was like, maybe I should do my first like heartbreak album. So that sparked what the album was going to be about. And then I wrote one piece and was in doubt of whether it should be an album or just like one song. But then it started to unfold with thought there would be more, the single. And then it turned into a heartbreak album, but a very like collaborative one.
Right.
Because I realized that for me, a heartbreak is very much about like actually getting close to many people. You're losing one in your life, or at least it's changing its form or how you're relating to each other. But at the same time, you get the opportunity to become closer to like friends and family and new people in your life. And so I also thought that the music should kind of portray that. And that was why it became my most like collaboratory album so far.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's also fun because it reframes the title, right? Because it's called Limerence, which is that, you know, that feeling of completely intoxicated in loveness. But that could also happen with other people in your life and another kind of excitement, I guess.
That's
like really fascinating.
Yeah.
Should we play that track you mentioned?
Yeah, we should play it.
Yeah, I thought there would be more. We can talk about it afterwards.
Thank you. You give me cold and you can give me the heat. You give me half and you can fulfill my needs. You give me nothing I can lean on to. You give me nothing I can lean on to. Is it too much to ask for more? Is it too much to ask for
I mean, hard relate.
I was going to ask about, like, what were some of the musical influences for the record. I just remember now when we played it, at actually at the beginning of the song, it kind of reminded me of Bjork and Vulnicula phase.
Oh, nice.
But also, like, the whole record has this kind of, feels like there's a bit of, like, R&B influence, but also in some ambient way, which is also...
Yeah.
Seems like a thing right now, but also like Kalela's latest record or stuff like that. So I don't know, like, what were you listening to?
Yeah, at that point, I was listening to a lot of like heartbreak albums, actually. Mm. And like to mention one of them, I think like FKA Twix and both the Magdalene, but also the Capri songs was a big influence. I was very inspired at that time by, and still are, by like... the texture of the voice, and like it's my most like whispering album so far, because I got really into like just turning up the microphone and then sing really quietly, which FK Twix does so well. So that was maybe one of the main influences or inspirations. And then also like Tim Hager, I think.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you can hear it in the song, but...
Yeah, but the whole ambient the vibe and the textures.
Yeah. I love the Konoye album. Especially with the string instruments, and like I'm very inspired by that. Yeah.
And I like how you speak about it, like, you know, that's my heartbreak album and these are some other heartbreak albums, like... this type of, you know, like it's a category.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, was it easier for you to work on that when you decided, like, oh yeah, like this is going to be my heartbreak album, like, you know?
Yeah.
Like you kind of step out of this personal experience and like treat it as a, I don't know if that makes sense.
There is so much good music about like heartbreak and like the heart. And also, like, it was kind of a different way of approaching or theme-wise compared to, like, before I've worked with, for example, Tides or A Dream Diary or Friendship or... But it has all, like, kind of related to where I was at that time. Mm-hmm. So I'm very much, like, inspired by my own life and my friend's life. And then I kind of... I needed to do it in a way.
Yeah,
because that was what... I sung about and then thought there would be more, was kind of, I often work with like deciding to have a theme. I like make a lot of songs and then I'm kind of figuring out what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
And then thought there would be more was kind of like a prototype track of what I wanted to like explore.
Mm.
Because I saw this film called Boyhood. Have you seen it?
No, but I know of it. It's the Richard Linklater movie, right?
Yeah, it's like they recorded it for like more than 10 years, I think. And it's about like a boy who grew up.
Yeah.
And the mother, when he moves out, says that a very like touching scene where she's like, I thought there would be more. And I was like, I could really relate to that feeling, like when you're shifting form in a way in your life and you're like, was that just it? Can I let it go now? But I have to, because I have to give room for new experiences.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I thought that was very like, it touched me really much, that scene.
Yeah, because it's also that thing of like, whether or not you can let it go, it is gone.
Exactly.
So it's like, can you get comfortable with that reality, right? Like it's, which is also very much the heartbreak thing as well. And then the heartbreak of like, it does refer to the existence of love, right?
Yeah.
Like it was there, it was real.
Yeah.
I'm also liking this idea of like thinking of Tim Hecker as heartbreak music because it's like so apocalyptic.
Yeah.
Like that kind of intensity is part of the experience and you often think about it in like, terms of like kind of Anthropocene or like, you know, big sort of concept things like this, but actually in the experience of heartbreak it's like the end of the world.
And also like the drama, I think like a thing I really like in making music is the drama. like to emphasize feelings and also one of my friends told me about this album that it was very like dramatic or I don't know the right word for it, but I was like, but it has to be.
Yeah.
But it's the best source material.
But like, I mean, because it is too much. Like that's also the feeling you get when you have the heartbreak is like you're you feel silly because of how too much it feels like.
Exactly.
And that you have to catch that.
Yeah.
Mm. Otherwise it's just you would, you know, you go, hey, you'll move on, life will be no, but it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
And that's key. So the too muchness I think is the point.
But maybe like in a way you can also enjoy that, you know.
Yeah, there's a catharsis to it. Like just like embrace it, be fully in that space. Yeah.
Or in best case use it to make a good record.
Yeah, catch the energy and take it on. You mentioned before like the previous like so on your previous records, how long has the project been going for, Alto Aria?
Alto Aria, I think 4 years. Mm. I released Tides in 2020.
Yeah, because it's been prodigious, like an album a year, like two albums in 2022.
Yeah.
Like, so yeah, you're just caught by this project right now. Like what's what was the idea behind developing that, like Alto Aria in general?
What was it? I played in different bands before I started Alto Aria, and then I really wanted to like try to express myself by producing more, and then I started out making my own songs, and then I got really caught by the computer. I was like, wow, this is so much fun. And also like I think I really found out how much I like making music while trying to learn a DAW.
Mm.
And like also I think of myself as a collector in a way, like a carrier bag of sound.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really inspired by like arranging and collecting all these sounds in the DAW and singing with them and stretching them and just recording a lot and putting it into the DAW or finding samples or...
I should say, for any listeners not aware, a DAW is a DAW, a digital audio workstation.
Yeah.
For a second I was like, is it a DAW? No, no, okay. Yeah. It's because it becomes a different space in which to experience the sound. Sorry, I feel like I cut you off a bit.
No, it was good.
But the carrier bag idea was also behind one of the compilations
by
your label, RISM.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess this is something that's like...
Been
brewing for a long time, or like this idea is...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think like I have some inspirations, which is like in a way penetrating all my work in a way. Yeah.
But that also, like, I guess, made sense with the label that you started with Metz.
Yeah.
Metz, we get a full name on the radio.
Metz Krobuge.
There we go.
Having a project under the name Skau.
El Skau.
No, just Skau.
Just Skau.
Yeah.
Yeah, so like it seems like the whole label idea as well is kind of in a way based on this like communal effort and like being connected and, you know, also trying to build a community, not just being like, okay, we're just putting out these records by these people, but like there seem to be a lot of collaborations, compilations.
Yeah, I think like... we are having a lot of fun with like doing compilations and want to do it more. Because it just makes sense to kind of make albums with a lot of people and like trying to build a community. And we are mostly like based in Copenhagen now also because I moved back and now we are both based here. And most of the artists are based in Copenhagen too. But just like, building a community together and like discussing. When we do a compilation, we often send a text or like have this idea we want to like have as a starting point for the composers to use in their music. And then also like having discussions with the artists about like, for example, the Hypersea compilation we did recently with Astrid Naimani's The Hydro Feminism text. And it just made some very good discussions about like, what does the text actually mean and how can it be used? And the music came out so different, like... Some made ambient tracks, some made a field recording, some like a almost club track. And
yeah, but I feel like that one and also the one that was like loosely based on Ursula Le Guin's essay, like they're both kind of very coherent for compilations. It doesn't feel like, you know, everyone just sending in whatever they were working on. It really feels like a group effort.
Yeah.
And do you think it comes out of like having this kind of like engaged sort of conversational way of like, you know, sitting with like the same text or like having something in common and then actually talking through what's perplexing about it or what's so there's actually some sort of like you're guiding each other, kind of like teaching along the way in a sense.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And also like the name of the label itself, right? It's like Deleuze and Guattari.
Exactly. So rhizome is also it's a root structure without a sender, like ginger or turmeric is a rhizome. And we both, me and Mess, read some of the
A Thousand Plateaus.
And was very like drawn towards that name and was like, it sounds really beautiful, this without a sender, and also like seeing community in that way. Like also we talked about this Brian Eno idea of seniors instead of genius. And like I very much believe that we do it together. So it's not like one person who is like creating the scene. It's more like we are many people creating the scene together.
Yeah.
if that makes sense.
No, it did. Yeah. I mean, like, it's like the only way anything happens is like,
exactly.
Like, you know someone who can like fill in like a skill, like whether it's like promoting or like bass playing or something. Mm. Like, you need, you know, that can change the arrangement of an entire thing.
Like feeding off of each other.
Yeah.
And like influencing each other.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's important for the growth of the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's also the nice thing about like the whole like rhizome concept. Also, like actual rhizomes, is you can just break off any part of it, and you could plant it, and it would grow a new thing from itself. Like, there's no bit which is too small to like, become something new. Which I guess also then ties back into the whole breakup record or heartbreak record. Is like rupture and repair is actually a part of a process of growth, and like accepting that or coming to terms with it. Do you think it actually was a record of coming to terms with it, or do you think it's, as you said, like, I guess, changing your position in the world in some way? Or
I feel like I had the, for the album, I had the working title for all the broken hearts which refuse to be broken.
Mm.
So it was very much this idea of like not being a half person, because we have been taught this idea about like when you lose someone, then you become half.
Mm. Yeah.
But I don't believe that is true.
Mm.
So more seeing it as like, I refuse to be broken. I have a heartbreak, and I'm losing someone, or it's shifting form. But I'm still a full human being. And
yeah.
I guess speaking of the collaboration and the community theme, I was wondering if we could maybe play another track, like the one which you have with, is it a cover of a Polly song? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's a demo I brought today because I wanted to show what I'm working on now.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I'm working on a cover / remix / collaborative album where I invite people or friends or musicians I am inspired by to send their stems, and then I'll recreate that into a new piece. And Polly sent me the stems for her song I Give Up, and then this is what I've made so far.
And I guess we should mention that Polly's also on Rhizome.
Yeah. Polly's also on Rhizome.
Thank you.
So it's like, so you're kind of working like kind of like a remixing sort of like style, or like, are you also singing in this, or what's the?
Yeah, I'm also
okay,
singing.
You're singing. Yeah.
Both. Yeah. There are some pieces by Polly, and then I'm singing the on it now also.
Oh, nice. Okay, so yeah, so it's like a full kind of jam sort of thing, like, but on a door.
Yeah.
Nice. So how do you like, I because I'm not familiar with Polly's work at all.
No.
So I'm wondering, like, how
is it from her record?
Yeah, it's from her record called Invitation, which
that was more like a pop record.
Yeah, and I Give Up is actually a choir piece on the record, very beautiful one. And then I took some of the stems and put it into a grid and read the lyrics, and I was like, this is actually about not following him anymore. Like, I give up on following him, and I was like, it has to have it could also have a beat of like walking away from following anyone. It was really fun making.
It's like to riff on your friend's ideas as well. Or like, so it's almost like it kind of becomes a conversation, I guess, between the two of you, but like via music making in some way.
Yeah.
But apart from like, working with DAWs and making stuff on the computer, like what else is your musical background, like instruments and stuff?
So the first instrument I was taught was piano. And then my sister was so much better than me, so I shifted to guitar. And then I played guitar for many years, and then found out that I could sing while playing and make songs that way. And then I became really interested in like singing. And then I created some bands and went studying philosophy, actually, which was kind of like another thing, but was singing very much in that period. And then I applied for the conservatory as a singer, actually.
As a singer,
So, yeah, I'm very interested in the voice, and also, like, I sing on other people's track and, I think.
Yeah, you featured on Croatian Amor.
Yeah, exactly. So
you really are doing a project where you're using your entire education in different ways. Then, like, you got the philosophy stuff going on, and you have the and the music training. It's all coming together. It's so rare that gets to happen.
But also in an unpretentious way.
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's important.
Yes.
I'm glad.
Well, I mean, it's like, it's difficult to be pretentious and make a record that's like emotionally too much. Because I was like, that's just, it's not cool. And that, or it risks not being cool, right? Yeah, like it risks that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was also, one of the features about like the record, which is really nice, is it does play in that space of like tension and risk quite a lot. Just the intensity of some of the bass drops in it. And then I think like structurally how you have set that against like these very sharp kind of dissonant, sometimes string samples. I think there's like some broken glass in there at some point as well. I don't know. Am I right?
Yeah, I think.
Okay.
I'm very like into like broken in the elements, and also like creaks, like.
Yeah, because it has that flavor about it where